Blog Talk Radio.
Hopefully I didn't program no intro thing. Good, I didn't. All right. I know I said I wasn't going to do a show this week, because I didn't, because I needed a break from this. But I got one of my favorite people here that we have some deep talks with. And today we were just talking, just a casual, you know, talk that we do periodically on what's up and how things are. And God really put on me, he said, let her interview you, because there's a lot about you maybe people don't know and want to know, because you got new listeners, new viewers, and Lord knows I got new haters. So with that, that's what we're going to do. This is not scripted. I don't know anything she's going to ask. You guys want to ask anything, you can call in 646-716-4621, press 1, so I know you want to comment. We'll put you on if you got a question or a comment. Let me see. The only thing that's not on the table, of course, is my ongoing lawsuit with Waco. That's not on the table. That's not open for discussion. I'm not going to take shots at Waco or the police department, but everything's going to be on the table with that. Let me introduce you guys to your host of this show, Miss Rachel Payne.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, yes. Thank you, Sandman Mason, for turning things over to me. It is an honor, a privilege, and a pleasure, sir, to speak with you. So from this point on, I'm just going to call you Stan, because I'm in charge. So Stan is in the hot seat tonight. And by hot seat, I don't mean that we're going to grill you, but you did say I could ask anything. Nothing was off limits. You gave the parameters of what you can't talk about, but everything else is on the table. And I think it is a wonderful opportunity and very generous of you to open yourself up like this, not only to your loyal viewers, but anyone else who wants to know, you know, who is the consciousness behind Stan the Man Mason? You know, who is it really that hosts behind the blue curtain? Who is this officer? What is his lived experience? And what are your opinions and thoughts on things that are relative to today? So it is with great pleasure and esteem that I open this show with you and host it for the next couple of hours, and I hope for those that are viewing, they have an opportunity to better understand your point of view, my point of view, and their point of view as well, be able to hear some things that might make them question and think about where they stand on things or make them want to take a stand. So without further ado, we're going to start our interview, and I encourage our Facebook viewers to chime in, ask questions. We may not be able to get to everyone, but we have allowed enough time and space to really dialogue here, and that's what we're going to do. I do want to say, I first met you, Stan, as Officer Mason. Back when I was in high school, I saw you in the Waco High Gym playing with some students, playing basketball outside of uniform, just a regular guy. You could have been anybody's dad or uncle. And it was just like, who's that really tall guy over there, you know? And from there, I began to see you around in the community, at school, different places, cordial and polite, and develop just a kinship about seeing each other. Like, hey, that's my brother who happens to be a police officer. And that felt good, knowing someone on the force that you knew had your back. And so that's my personal experience of how I met you and how I got to know who you were. But if you would you tell our viewers today who Stan Mason is, where you're from, what you used to do, and how you got to the point that you are now in a nutshell? And I do want to give one more caveat to our show, because I know you and I can go long on any subject matter. I've got, I'll say, maybe a stop button, a pause button where we can move on. And I'll say, that's 100, Stan. And we'll leave it at that. And I'll give you a chance. If you want to make one more point, you can do so. But we're going to keep the conversation going so we can go deep with it. All right. So tell us, who is Stan the Man Mason?
All right. Stan Mason, born 1962, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. What's up, Harrisburg? 1820 Bow Street. Bow Street forever. I spent 11 years in the United States Air Force. Got out of the Air Force, moved to Waco, Texas, where my mother was from Waco, became a Waco police officer, was there for 25 years, and now I'm just kicking back for the last 4.5, almost 5 years now. We've been doing Behind the Blue Curtain, which I did, you know, while I was working for approximately years. So this isn't something we started after police reform. We kept it going. Ironically, in high school, somebody sent me this picture and reminded me the other day, I was voted most radical in high school, you know. So it's amazing how everything becomes full circle.
Mm-hmm. Awesome, awesome. And I want to say we got Cynthia Mason Posey watching on Facebook. She said he has always been driven by any wrong. Yeah, as a child, he took a brick to the playground to take on boys older and bigger than him who had wronged him. Thank God our mom knew him better than he knew himself and got there first. Thank God for good mamas.
You know, she
all right, so.
That she brought up
absolutely.
It's like a lot of kids today. I didn't, you know, she's right. I didn't take a pistol, but, you know, I have my sisters. You know, I was the most like my father, that protector thing, you know. I like when she chimes in and brings things like that because I wasn't Greg or Peter Grady. You know, I wasn't by any stretch, but. You know, the whole neighborhood, when I grew up, the whole neighborhood, you got a whipping from the playground to the house by every grown-up that was there.
Right.
So, you know, I want people to understand that this isn't just, you know, I'm the byproduct of not just my mother and father, but my sisters, my brother. And on our block, on Bow Street, everybody was your brother or sister, quite literally. I could walk in anybody's house and eat. And they could come into ours. We were that way growing up. So, you know, I appreciate her.
Absolutely. And we appreciate her as well. And speaking about your character, she spoke to your character as a boy that, you know, you didn't let anybody pick on you and you weren't about being bullied. So is that what led you into becoming a police officer, taking up for the little man?
You know what? Actually, really, I had two run-ins with police growing up. Great question, because the first run-in I had, we hear so much of North and South, and the South is the racist people, and the North is supposedly the good people. My first run-in with the police was Harrisburg Police, and I was coming from, me and a friend of mine, we were about 10 years old, we were coming from a shopping center one Saturday, Monday morning, it was in the summer, and the police stopped us because a lady's purse had gotten snatched like 5 or 6 blocks away from where we were. But they picked us up. And I remember being put in the police car in the back of the old, you know, those old police cars. And this is like 1972. I knew that that was not the place to be. And that I knew I was in trouble, not because we had done anything, but even at that age, I knew it's all it's going to take is for this lady to have the mindset, they're good enough. Those two will do. And my life would have been ruined. But, you know, they took us to the lady. She said, no, it wasn't them. And, you know, we were still like a mile and a half from home, me and my friends. The police just put us out right there. They didn't drive us home to our parents. They didn't explain to our parents why they stopped us. They just pretty much put us out. So I get home. I tell my mom about it. And my dad was like, you know, my hero. And my dad was like, I'll take care of it. He called down. He spoke, had the sergeant and the officers come out, and the whole neighborhood is out in the street watching this. And I remember watching my dad read these officers their riot act right there in the middle of the street. And to me, that was empowering to me because even though it's Pennsylvania, you just didn't do that to the police. So, you know, when we came to Waco to visit my mom's family, that's where she was from, when we stayed for a month, when I'm leaving Waco, I remember these two white Waco officers came into the bus station when it was downtown, the old Greyhound station downtown. And these guys spent time with me, let me touch the bullets. At that time, they had the bullets that went all the way around their belt. You know, they let me touch the bullets, and they shook my hand. And it was kind of strange because here's the South where these racist people were supposed to be. And these officers were totally different than the officers I had in Harrisburg.
Mm-hmm.
So I remember telling my mother I was going to be a Waco policeman in the 70s. She never lived to see it. But, you know, I was. I became one. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't even to fulfill what I had told her. It's just I felt that's what I needed to do and where I needed to be.
Mm-hmm. All right. All right. Well, that's 100, Stan. And it is. And I'm sure, you know, for her to know that her son has made the impact that he has made, I'm sure that that would make her very proud. Someone here said that you always gave it straight. You know, you were the kind of person that would keep it 100 with them and straight no chaser. So we are happy to have you having served in that capacity. And at this point, being able to use your platform and your experience and your knowledge to empower, wake up, and enlighten other people. Still talking about being a police officer, I want to ask you, Waco has invested, and I'll say I'm in Waco. Shout out to Waco, Texas. It is important that I talk about what's kind of going on in our community. Our city council has invested quite a bit in community policing, and we have a new police chief, Dr. Cheryl Victorian, and she is someone that comes with great credentials and background from a larger city and community in Houston and is coming to Waco. What do you think, you know, community policing should look like? We've got a new person that is open, came for the purpose to fulfill the council's needs, the city manager's request. What do you feel like community policing looks like, and what should it look like in Waco, Texas?
In the early 90s, when Waco initially dabbled in community policing, retired now, Commander Claire Crook, she is who put all that together in Waco. And she got us top-notch training. The six of us, when Waco was divided, you know, there was, I think at that time there were like 24 neighborhood associations. But each one of us had six neighborhood associations that I was responsible for. Carver East, Riverside, Landon Branch, North Waco, Cedar Ridge, and Brook Oaks. And for the most part, I pretty much had the worst part of town. I think the concept and the idea behind it the first time that they tried it, which it did work, was that it would be a concept that would envelop the department and everyone. So you can't do community policing with six people. If Waco says, well, we're going to have 50 community police officers, that's not good.
Mm-hmm.
Community policing has to be everybody, the janitor, the ladies and men at the front desk, the dispatchers, the detectives, the homicide, the SWAT team, it has to be everyone. It can't be, if you have anything less than everyone, you have a crime prevention unit. That's all you have.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to hire people who fit that mode of policing that you want to do. Because we can't transform everybody. We're seeing in policing right now, we can't even train some of the biases and tendencies out of people to get them to stop doing wrong that are costing cities millions.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got to change hiring practices too.
Right, right. Okay, so my next question, it may sound like a simple yes or no to some people, but I know you, it is not a simple yes or no, but I'll ask it as yes or no. Defund the police, yes or no?
No.
All right, tell us why on your no.
Because when I hear defund the police is a hashtag that's thrown out for people to, you know, they want to be able to say, okay, I'm in the conversation, defund the police, and it sounds good, but the fact of the matter is you can't defund the police because if you defund the police, where does that money go? That money now goes back into what we call the city's general fund. What does the city do with that money? Whatever they want. And then when you say, we don't have a power program, we want to do this, we want to do that, you don't have access to those funds. You've got to go back and wait on next budget year. And the thing is, for a lot of the people who yell, defund the police, if I were to ask them, have you read the police budget? Do you know how much is spent on training? Do you know how much is spent on hiring? Do you know how much is spent there? They don't know. It's just a popular thing to say, and it makes no sense when you say it. Because who's the sergeant over the neighborhood you work in, that you live in? Three sergeants, day shift, afternoon shift, midnight shift. What are their names? I don't know. How about the officers who work your area? The three officers, day, night, and evening. You know? No, I don't know. What's the chief's name? I don't know. You don't know anything about the police department, but you want to defund it.
Mm-hmm.
If your police department isn't broken, don't try to fix it. Try to work with it.
Say it. Say it. You're right. And I think that is a great response and a lens to look at it. There's no one size fits all, and it's got to be based on the community. And the only way that you even really have understanding is to educate yourself on that before you answer that question and say, you know what, I don't know yet because I haven't looked at them close enough to make that decision. But, yeah, I think you definitely got to go by your community. What are the standards and the goals that you have, and how can y'all achieve that, whether that is with budget or with programming or with training? You got to be able to look at it not just in the black and white and the yes and the no. I got another question with you because we started with what everybody knows you, so we're still on policing, but I want to talk about some mental health. As part of what goes on in a crisis situation, oftentimes people call 911 and say, you know what, I have a loved one here who suffers from an illness, but they're having a bad moment right now. There's nothing we can do with them to calm them down or calm them to reason with them. So they send the police. Who should we be sending on those calls, and what should they be doing?
You know, I think particularly Texas. In Texas, they literally dumped the entire mental health catastrophe on the police. They did. And police chiefs didn't like it, but by and large, it got done. City managers weren't screaming about it too much because if they were, they would have backed the police chiefs who weren't happy with it. The police unions virtually said nothing about it. So we're talking about the power play, political power play entities right now. They didn't say anything about it, but it fell on the men and women out there on the street we are not trained mental health professionals. I don't care what they want to tell you. We have 5 mental health specialists in the department. Okay, how many people you got in your city? Now, I work midnights. How many of these 5 mental health people are out there at midnight? I recently posted an article that Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, where my hometown, where the a mental health officer went out with a lady with a gun that wanted to take her own life. And he ended up hugging her. Imagine if every officer had that training that that officer had. How much of a difference it would make. And when I hear about cost, when I hear about the cost of it, I have to question Texas. You want to give everybody a gun now. You know, forget it, taking handgun classes. Forget, give everybody a gun. So then what about the amount of time officers have to spend on the range to be certified? Let's take some of that money then and put it into certifying them in mental health. Not to be certified professionals, but to be able to have a working understanding until someone that's qualified gets there.
You're right about that. And as you say, they're making life and death decisions. It's the difference between your loved one being there the next day after that call and being there the months and years after it. And I think that brings us to a point as a matter of fact, the reason why we even got steered to today's interview, you had a very stimulating dialogue with someone on your show the other night when you were on in the evening, and the gentleman was obviously of a conservative viewpoint. You gave him much grace to speak that viewpoint, no matter how much he side-pedaled, backstroke, and came back to his point. You respected that he was free to express that opinion on your show. But one of the things that he said was, you know, oh, that's a bad apple. You know, that's a one bad apple. Well, as a police officer, yeah, it makes you laugh. Funny lying laugh. But like that's a bad apple in a police department for the whole world. You cannot go to any other profession and say, well, you know, we got a few bad pilots, but 90% of our planes make it there. And police officer standards should be, you know, very high. When you entrust someone to protect and serve your community, you arm them with not only a weapon but training. You know, you expect them to be good apples as much as possible. But I want to say this. Reason I brought up bad apples, what should happen to those rotten, bad apples in terms of you never being able to hold another gun and point it at another person and legally walk away from that situation or be given grace to say maybe you made the right decision and needs to be investigated. You don't get to be in that position anymore. What should be happening to these bad apples?
Well, 3 years ago, four years ago now, when we started this show, we started with Facebook Live. We handled questions like this, and we talked about things like establishing a database of bad officers so they can't leave one department and go to the next department. We were crazy, radicals, they're lunatic, he needs a psych evaluation. Now, what is everybody politically doing? Exactly what we said. You know, if you're convicted of domestic violence in Texas, you can't have a gun. So how can we fire someone from a municipal job and civil service or with standards, and then we for brutality or abusing someone's rights, and then we allow them to go down the street and say, well, we have no way of tracking that. You can track child predators. You can track domestic violence people. You can track terrorists. We can track everything else but that.
Mm-hmm.
And we as the public let them know that's crazy.
Yeah.
These people should not be allowed to be security guards. They should not be in a position where they have authority over other people because they've demonstrated that they can't control themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So no,
mm-hmm.
they should be blackballed from the profession.
Absolutely. I like that. That's 100.
Okay. I'm waiting on the next one.
All right. I love that. Blackball from the profession. I think that's what you ask for when you say you suffer the consequences. Not only do you go through the same legal system that other criminals go through, but you're banned from your profession, never to return again. I wouldn't let you be a dog catcher in our town.
but in
all
that,
right.
The thing, the problem with having that actually come to fruition, you and I can agree and say that is right. And people can oppose it, and that's their you know, choice. But this is a problem. Policing has demonstrated one thing. It is incapable, unwilling, or just simply ain't going to do it, of looking at itself. Every major corporation in this country examines itself and says, what can we do better? How can we serve our customers better? What changes can we make? And policing, by and large, has not made these changes, has not done that autopsy. Has not done that forensic study, and that's why we see pattern in practice over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
There's no quality.
Mm-hmm.
There's no standards whereby the community can say you are not living up to the standards. That's part of the
mm-hmm.
reason why you got some chief shopping. Look at some of these police chiefs. Every 2 years, you see them going. You're reading they're at another department. You're like, you weren't there long enough to do anything over here.
Let me ask you, Stan, a follow-up to that. How do you feel like a community scorecard would do for police departments, allowing the community to grade their performance every year and give them direct feedback?
One of the things that Claire Crook did when she was putting together our community policing unit, and I don't want to hear people say we can't do this. We did this in the 90s, so technology has improved, so we can damn sure do it now. One of the things that Commander Crook did is she had a survey sent out in the water bill, a little five-question survey where people just circled and rated us, the department, 1 to 5, how they
mm-hmm.
felt. And the beauty of that survey, we could take those statistics instead of saying, well, North Waco likes the police and East Waco doesn't. We could break that down into school zones. We could break it down into council districts. We could break it down into city improvement zones. We could break it down into police beef, because all the tables were set so the numbers could be extruded according to
mm-hmm.
whatever geographic area you wanted to look at. And it was very interesting because you found that even within an area where you said Waco PD rates high, when you went into particular mm-hmm. pockets, you showed we didn't rate high. And what is the demographic in which we did not rate high? See, that's doing groundwork. She did that in the 90s. So people can't say today it can't be done. I think it should be done. I think it should be done twice a year. Send it out in the water bill and then make it transparent. to where it comes out in the Bay of Larry, it comes out in the Waco Tribune, and it's get released to the media. Don't just make it some internal hush-hush memo. Let the citizens all over the city see what the citizens think of their department, because that's who we work for.
Absolutely. I love that, and I hope if no one else is here to pick it up and listen to it, that's something I can share with our community leaders here. It's been done and can be done in our community again. So I think that was the solution right there. All right. I'm going to put a pin in policing for just a moment because I know we got some people that want to know how you feel, excuse me, and where you stand on some different things. Something you and I talked about is your belief system. You know, what's your guiding principles and what keeps you grounded when the world wants to tell you to think and be a certain way, Stan lives differently. So what's, just briefly, what's your code, Stan? What code do you live by?
My dad and my mom, they were just simple people. And there was right and wrong. There were no parameters. They didn't fill it up with a whole bunch of crap. It was either right to do it or was wrong to do. And, of course, in the military, it's just right and wrong, left and right. That's it. That's it. That's all there is. In policing, I was fortunate enough that I had Commander Claire Crook. And she would always preach to us. If you're wrong, I'm going to get you. And she knew the book. She's going to get you if you're wrong. But she said, mm-hmm. Is it morally right? And is it ethically right? If those mm-hmm. two things fit, you're okay. Even if the world disagrees with you, she said, I can see how you made the decision you made. I can see why you did what you did. Even if I don't agree with it, I can understand how you got there. And she valued being able to understand our decision-making, sometimes even more than the decision we made,
mm-hmm.
which was phenomenal. And so I kind of encompassed that. And, you know, you sit in roll calls and you listen to people, officers who never have lived in a specific community, whether they're black officers in the white community or white officers in the black community. They have no experience other than the calls they work, but they become an expert. And that's dangerous because that's what politicians do. Mm-hmm. So when you take a person's life and take it an inconvenience and you purport it as such, we don't solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
That would get angry. But when I went to these houses where these people didn't even have, they open a refrigerator, there's nothing in there but a bottle of water, and it's August, and I'm sweating, and they say, Officer Mason, you want something to drink? That's all they got. And they're giving it to you.
Yeah.
That makes a difference.
Absolutely. Absolutely it does. Let's talk a little bit about something that most people will probably say is the discussion of the day. Right now we're living in a time where we are seeing our nation have a consciousness shift. We are becoming more aware and more outspoken about what we see in plain sight that doesn't make sense. And you just can't explain away by changing the narrative. And that's race. You know, we've seen a lot around race. We can talk about George Floyd or Philando Castile, but talking about what you see every day in your neighborhood or with your family, with your wife, people who know that your wife is a Caucasian woman, you know, and that's still, you know, taboo in some communities and in some eyes. Tell me what you feel like the temperature is around race and for you particularly, you know, what are your experiences right now going through what we're going through as a country as we progress from a pandemic?
I think that for me, you know, as far as with my wife, you know, I think my wife has endured more than I've had to because, I'll tell somebody go to hell in a minute. That's just me because they're not paying the bills. Here. I don't care if they're black or white. The bills aren't coming with their name on it. Get over it. Fix your stuff at your house. So I don't worry so much about that. She endures a lot. But, you know, she's done a lot of work to learn about Tulsa and to learn about, you know, Jesse Washington. And she'll come to me, and she's proud. Look, hey, I learned this, and I did that. And she does it on her own. I don't tell her, go read this. But she sees through, number one, being married to me is no day at the beach. And it's for her to be able to put up with what I do and the show and have the people that come at her because they can't come at me, it makes me respect her. And I think race is something that people don't want to see. I hate when people say, well, I don't see color. Well, to not see color is to not see me. And to not see me is not to see what I go through.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes the people who say, well, I don't see color is because they're in a world where they don't have to. Everything is given to them.
Thanks.
And it's not to say that all white people are bad or all black people are bad. That's not it. But we got to have this conversation. You know, I mean, as a black police officer, I was not immune to being Freddie Gray, Tamir Rice, Austin Sterling, Philando Castile. I'm not exempt from that. And neither is any other police officer walking around right now. Well, they should have just complied. I'd say, well, take off that uniform, get in the car, and drive across your state. Then tell me that. And that's a real issue that I refuse to pretend doesn't exist. Race exists. Discrimination exists. Implicit biases, we all have them. It exists. But nobody wants to talk about it. And now it's out there.
Yeah. Yeah, America's flip is showing.
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
I think
and then
you a great next one because that statement was 100. But let me tell you, your sister also mentioned that the Senate refused to vote for a commission to investigate the January 6th riots. So I'm going to give you one of those yes or no questions again, and then feel free to expound. So January 6th, false flag or insurrection?
Insurrection / treason.
All right, talk about it.
Well, imagine in the most simplistic terms I can put it, someone broke into your house. You call me, Officer Mason shows up. Your front door is laying in the front yard, your TV's gone, your house is ransacked, and I walk in, I go, well, I don't think anything happened here. It was just tourists, and I left.
Yeah, looks
would
like
you
just had house.
Would you have the police department complaining? That was the people's house.
Yes. So
and,
let me ask
you. Know,
yes, ma'am. I said, let me ask you with that. You're right. Everything that you said was an obvious point, but I just wanted people to hear you say it. So let's move on to the real issue. We know what happened. We all saw it with our own eyes, and we don't need anyone to interpret it. At this point, why are some of our elected leaders refusing to categorize it as such and move forward with an investigation, knowing that, what do we do about it?
Some of these folks got some hidden strings attached to some stuff that's going to come out through the Southern District. And I'm not giving a political far-fetching conspiracy. It's going to come out. Second thing is, America might as well put on this big boy pants. Guess what? You are browning. To the ultra-black folks who want everybody to be super black, it ain't going to happen for a long time. To the white folks that don't like the fact that everybody ain't going to be white, guess what? Strap in because it's getting that way now. America's browning. These young people coming up are not homophobically hung up. They're not racially hung up. They're dialoguing. They're marrying. They're enjoying life. And so I think America is afraid of losing a segment, a definition of America that a select few have enjoyed. And she's going to become America intended to be.
You're right. And I'm going to say, Cynthia said, because it infringes on their sense of entitlement.
Mm-hmm.
That's right on. That's right on. So talking about entitlement, I'll say for everybody that knows, we know how the entitlement came about. It was on the backs of slaves. The enslaved people of Africa that were brought here, you know, built this country with their free labor and sacrificed more than we'll ever know to see rewards reaped by others. And at this stage in the game, it's like we're starting Monopoly, you know, 400 years after the first players and all the properties bought up and we're trying to edge our way in. In this day and age, when you look at it and see that things are definitely held in a majority of hands, how do you fight back against that? And I guess the question is, Stan, how do our black and brown people, you know, start late in the game where we are and unite to make something happen? And that can be anything. That's the policing. That's the local government. That's what you need done in your town. How do we do that starting from behind?
Two key people to follow. First, Frederick Douglass said, without struggle, there could be no progress. There's a difference between having a hard life and struggling. Struggling is fighting against the hard life. Some of us aren't doing that. James Baldwin also said, I can't believe what you say because I see what you do. So number one, we got to look at where we get our information from and how consistently we get that information. I say, you know, we're tired of the white jury. But how many of us are trying to get out of we've all said in jury duty, and you've heard the conversation. You know, I ain't got time for this. I got to be somewhere else. It's an inconvenience. But the white folks are sitting there doing the civic responsibility. Why should we constantly go beg and plead for us to vote when we're the ones constantly demonstrating and marching and protesting because we don't like a certain city ordinance or state or county law that's been enacted? Mm-hmm. See, we don't get to be professional victims, but that's that hard part of the conversation that you're not going to get anywhere. But people need to know it. You know, and I'm not going to be anybody's carpet. You're not going to be a lad. You ain't riding me. I ain't your magic carpet. If Stan don't like something, I'm going to go find out the minutes of this meeting and what's going on. You have to avail yourself of that system. You don't need to spit out, I have a dream speech. And that's what we've been having this dream speech so long, most of us are still asleep.
Say it.
We're not empowered. We're worried about losing something. Fact of the matter is, we don't have anything. And sometimes when you have nothing to lose, you're in a perfect position to fight. What are you scared of?
You're right about that.
I'm ready. Friday next one.
All
Can
right.
I be a caller that's up here on the 706? If you'd like to chime in, press 1, and I'll see a little question mark, and I'll light your phone up where you can come in. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rach.
Oh, no, not a problem. This is unscripted. It's for us. So everybody is included in the dialogue this evening. And ask what you want to ask of Stan the Man. So
can I get the caller in real quick?
Yeah, get him in. Let him in, please.
Yeah, you got a caller from the 706 area code 5416. Good evening.
Hey,
go
Stan.
Ahead,
this is Marla.
How you doing,
Marla Facey, Dr. Marla? How are you doing?
I'm doing well.
Okay. Praise the Lord. Good for you. Good for all y'all. I love this. I love the subject. Okay, so you're talking about the insurrection. And one of the things that I have a problem with the insurrection, and you kind of hit the head on it. Why these people don't want to vote to have a people looking at them. You know what I'm saying? Because the real reason behind all that is they really, a lot of those Republicans are behind it. They're the ones that helped start it. They're the ones that have been encouraging it. They're the ones that have they let the people come through the Capitol and walk around a couple of days before it happened. I live out here in the D.C. area. I'm in Maryland, and they had I got a friend of mine at church's son that's actually a Capitol Police officer, and he said that they got text messages saying that they didn't even want some of them to even come to work that day from the chief. So it's kind of like, and then he ended up giving his position up or whatever?
Resign.
Is that me? Resigning, yeah. I couldn't think of the word. Good child, forgive me. I'm getting old. I can't remember. But anyway, I'm looking and going, some of these people got to be behind it. And it just really frustrates me. And if they're not totally behind it, they don't want to speak up because they feel indebted to this situation. They feel indebted, or somebody will be on them, you know, like try to do something to their families or something like that. But there's got to be a reason why. If I was in the White House, in there, and my family was, you know, somebody was coming after us, if hang Mike Pence and all that, I would be trying to find out everything that I possibly could. it makes no sense. So I feel like that some a lot of them don't want their name being brought out. That's really all I have to say. Stan, you have a very a great show. I love it. And I probably have more stuff to say, but right now that's what I really wanted to share that because I really think that people are looking at something out of these Republicans that they never going to get. This is not – the country was not built for us. It was built on our backs. We're never going to be equal to, you know, to them. But on the other hand, I understand what you're saying, Stan. I agree with you 100%. We do a lot of things to ourselves. I go on jury duty every chance I get. I've been on jury duty in 6 states I live at, and I will go every time because I want to make a difference. I may be that one person that has that black young man that really I feel in my heart because God may have, I may have prayed about it and seen what's going on, and I feel in my heart that that person's not guilty. I may be the one that, the only one that can keep him from the death, you know, from being, what you call it, you know, convicted or put to death right. or whatever the case is. So we need to stand up just like they stand up and keep their people out of jail or keep them from having long sentences and stuff. We got to do our job too. So I go every chance I get. My husband goes because I'm not playing. I'm about that. Okay, enough on me. Love you. Bye-bye.
All right, Dr. Fancy. Thank you.
Thank
okay.
you,
Marla.
That was. That was absolutely 100, and I think she brought up some good points that tied into what you say. We don't use the system to our advantage. It may have not been created with us in mind, but as Americans, we partake in all of these liberties. So just educate us briefly. What's these things that we need to be doing that we got a right to do, voting, jury duty, owning a gun? Tell us how we should be using this system to our advantage.
You know, I think that, number one, and, you know, voting, absolutely. Absolutely. You got to be voting. If you can't vote, then go get somebody else who can and get them registered. In fact, go get 5 people to make up for you whatever you did so you couldn't vote. And, you know, the second thing is, get a, if your problem, for instance, I focus on police reform. I'm not an economics professor, so I look at where money is spent in police departments, and I pretty much know where money is spent and where money is wasted. And so when you hear, if you get a copy of that budget, you ought to be looking at it every year. How much money is spent on training for the patrol officers, not SWAT, not the drug enforcement unit, not the TAC unit, not all these specialized units that police departments brag about, but those men and women that you see out on the street every day, how much money is available to them for training? Y'all dig up Waco PD. Go look at Waco PD's budget. It'll shock you when you see the average amount of money allocated to patrol officers, not the shift, but individual officers when you do the breakdown. It would shock you. And it's not the patrol officer's fault. Don't blame them. You can't blame the chief. The chief's got to get a budget approved. Blame the people making the decisions. Because on one hand, you've got, and I'm not talking Waco right now, but you got city council people who want to talk about our officers need more training. We need to do, but you're the ones cutting the budget. So you know, you can't publicly cut the knees out from under the chief and then sit up and ask the chief why there isn't more training. Because the chief's too busy dealing with the officers that are in patrol that are saying, look, we don't have what we need out here. What are you going to do about it, chief? Because after every major incident, you hear the same excuse. They go out there and they say, we need more training, we need more training, we need more training. Sometimes training can't be the go-to car. Sometimes it isn't the training, it's the fair and equal application of the training the officers have received. Because the black officers aren't out there doing some of the stuff that some of the white officers are doing. They both went to the same training, so it's not the training, it's the application and when people choose to do it. And it's not to say all white officers are bad. It certainly isn't that. But when do we choose to implement the training, and which demographic are we saying, well, I'll let this de-escalation, I think I'll do that now. Sometimes that's not even on the table.
Absolutely. That's 100, Stan. That's 100. Let me tell you about one of your most fascinating shows for me, your show on colonial Christianity. I applaud you, my brother, for opening that can of worms and going fishing with it, because
it was for me what church should be, not the feel-good Sunday message, the same Easter sermon, you know, the things that we've read and we know. How do we apply Christianity to where we are right now in this moment, especially knowing the roots of it? And as you say, how can we call ourselves a Christian nation if we're not applying those principles right now? So just touch on that colonial Christianity and what that looks like today, what the remnants are that people don't even realize are colonial Christianity principles that we just accept as norms and we don't even question anymore.
You know, I think with that term, I kind of came into my head one night, colonial Christianity, is this concept that I see so many people today where you can have a police chief with an open door policy and a citizen can have a crisis. That citizen wants to talk to the chief, but for some reason, especially black people, we're conditioned to, I need to take the preacher there with me. Why? It's always been done that way. Why do you need him to speak for you? And I think that we, in the process of people getting into Christianity or any religion to better themselves, they become dumbed down and become followers, not individuals, not leaders. You need to have this person with you. In a lot of churches, you know, that you see the churches in the corner of murder and mayhem. But the pastor lives out in Lovely and Lacey. And that's fine if the pastor has a job. But when he lives out in Lovely and Lacey, because the people I'm answering the calls with, they don't have a pot to piss in or a window to throw it out of or putting their money in a tithing plate, which I'll call taxes, to make him live out there. But he becomes the expert when the murder happens. The media's there talking to him. Why? He's only there 3 times a week. Wednesday, Bible study. Saturday, fish fry. Sunday, church. And it's not every preacher. It ain't just Christianity, but we as black people have embraced it. And I think that sometimes what is pushed in America is a philosophy that while it is Christian in name only, it dumbs you down to keep you submissive. And the Jesus that I serve called stand to do what Stan is ordained to do, and don't worry about the feelings. God said, let me handle their feelings. We should be empowering people, not telling them to be long-suffering. And we've been the most forgiving people in the history of the world. We've been forgiving here for 400 years. We haven't built a gallows. We haven't taken revenge out on anybody. But, you know, I just think sometimes somebody's got to stand up and say, enough is enough. Mm-hmm. Forgiveness without a foolishness.
That's 100. And I still want to stay on that to talk about our preachers. You say, you know, we try to put them in a place where we don't need them. What do we need them to do? If the church is at the corner of murder and mayhem, why hasn't the hood come up with all the members and all the donations and all the tithes and offerings that go into those churches right into the community? In your opinion, what's going on? Why aren't our church members and preachers only churching in the church house and not really doing the work of God in the community with the people? How does that happen?
When you look at a lot of Reverend Frank Montgomery, Darren Waco comes to mind for me. When you look at these pastors, I'm not even going to call them preachers because preaching just means proclaim loudly and boldly, and you can preach nonsense loudly and boldly. But pastors, that means they aid, help, or assist another. Reverend Montgomery, as long as he's been there in Waco, Marshall Chapel, right there on 6th Street, was never afraid to lead the church, and he lived over on 7th Street. Never afraid to lead the church to walk across the street to the villages when the shooting was going on. Knew everybody by name. That connection is lost. And that is something that one, you know, like my sister said earlier in one of her comments, it takes a village. That village concept that we had is gone. I alluded earlier when I talked about my neighborhood. Remember I said you can go to anybody's house. They could come to yours. That's gone today. So our moral compass is spinning out of control. And we're so busy striving for attention that we forget to strive for results. I want likes and clicks. It doesn't matter that I look foolish. I just want likes and clicks.
I like that. I like that, and I think that leads into the next question. I think we look around and we see
in our society that people in power always have status. You know, whether they wear it on their wrist or drive it or live in it, you know who they are by the possessions around them. In most cases, even the most modest of millionaires probably doesn't live in a shack. So knowing that that is not our life, we are not those people making those salaries, what would you say our issues are with being consumers? And like you say, some people, that's consumers of likes and shares and popularity. It may be consumers of goods versus where we should be in looking at civic engagement and being more into how things are making our life easier, better, making society move forward versus adorning ourselves with treasure. So tell me about what you think when you look at the world and just the state of people walking around consuming information, consuming stuff, and not really going into the work of making real things and real change happen.
You know, I think that we've been conditioned. Once again, we get off track because we chase the shiny thing. We want
mm-hmm.
attention. One of the things that, you know, on our show, we talk about drug addiction. We have drug addicts as our guests. We talk about prostitution. We have prostitutes as our guests. I've got a guy to do 20-some years as a co-host on the show. So you got to go through something to be something. And that's just what I believe. I think that we get caught up with being around people who are great in name only, not in deed.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have any money, but Stan could go places in Waco the mayor can't go.
Mm-hmm.
I could go places the Ridgewood Country Club people can't go. No matter how great a detective you are, all the schools you've been to, I don't care that you're the chief. When you went into Estella Maxey, Trenwood, South Terrace, Cape Ross, Parkside, the Villages, Pecan Gardens, Sherman Manor, there were people who were going to come up and want to tell Stan what's going on that would not even talk to you because of respect. Respect is something people give you. You earn their respect, and you don't betray it. They trust you. And I think if we hit the brakes, you don't need a Rolex. You don't need Air Jordans. When you've got someone respect and trust, that will open doors for you that BMW can't drive through.
Uh-huh.
If you need to highlight somebody else's name to underscore your position, you're already weak. You should be able to walk into a room and the whole room turns around and looks. You don't have to say a word. You change the atmosphere of the room just because you showed up. Not for what you say, because God may give you something to say. That power. And be 100.
Stan, that was 100, and I ain't trying to cut you off, but that was the truth.
I mean, and I see that in the least of our people, drug dealers. Some of these little kids out there stealing cars, okay, let's not throw them down. Nobody ever told them you could beat somebody. If it wasn't for the grace of God, I could be any one of these people we read about today. There ain't nothing great about me. I've been fortunate. I've stumbled into making good decisions, and I've logically made a few in my life. But a lot of people guided me. And everybody wasn't a Harvard professor, and everybody wasn't rich that did it. But if I needed to get a hold of somebody in Waco to have power and position, if I called them, guess what? They called me back.
Uh-huh.
God will put you in a position to be able to get access to what you need when you need it. And they'll find you. You got to put the work in. And you put the work in with the least of the people, not just the ones you like or look like you.
Mm-hmm.
You got to put the work in.
You're right about that. That was 100, Stan. All right. So we often hear the term slave mentality, you know, used to categorize someone's behavior of African-American descent. And usually
it is describing a skittishness or a apprehension about doing something just because it was a forbidden or a something that was ingrained into our ancestors and has been passed down. And I'll say I got an old school friend that I hang with, and we had that conversation dialoguing about the slave mentality. And for her, this is what she told me. When she was growing up, she's about 65 right now, you know, things like investing in the stock market were around. But when the conversation may come up, if it came up in their house, they were told that's something that white people do. It wasn't always a conversation about being fearful of white people or being fearful about police. That wasn't only part of it. It was about the things that they could do and have access to and privilege to. And she said it wasn't said to her to say that you can't do it because you are black, but almost that it was not available to them. Like, don't try. Not necessarily don't try because you're black, but because it wasn't available. And some of those things are available. We have access now that we didn't have. But tell me what those symptoms that you see in our community that are, you know, the remnants of slave mentality that people don't even realize they're carrying on themselves.
I think some of it is through local leadership. When you're not reaching out, and if you know the community is not accessing information, whether it's school district information, whether it's city council information, if you're truly concerned, take the information to them. You know, I remember when Wednesday night church service started out, somebody would stand up and you had the representative that would go to the council meetings. They stand up and talk briefly about what was on the council's agenda. Then this person stood up and talked about, so for those of our parents who couldn't get there, you still knew something of what was going on. So that information, that was the leadership making sure we got the information. Now it's all about what you chose to do with it. I think it goes back to voting. We don't avail ourselves. You know, I know that Pat goes out of her way to make sure all the county information is out there with the leadership luncheons and getting guests and getting, but do we access that?
Mm-hmm.
Are we going
mm-hmm.
there? We don't get to be professional victims on one hand.
Mm-hmm.
And then marchers and protesters on the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't understand that.
Yeah,
you know, we have to make the right, and the information can, if we can find out what Beyonce had for breakfast, what color pants Jay-Z wore, what Michael Jordan's doing, what Kim Kardashian and the rest of these clowns are out here doing, we know all about that. But the things that are impacting us every day, ain't nobody got time for that. I don't care. My vote don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
We cut our own throat sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
I think it all relates. Using your civic rights, being in the places where you need to be versus, you know, out there, as my mama would say, fooling off time, doing other things that don't make a difference in the community nor in your life, but it's a waste of your money, it's a waste of your time. You get home, you're not further enriched and you hadn't made a difference, but you feel good about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, it's empowering when you can participate in a process like a jury and be a part of the decision and the outcome. It's empowering when you can write your name on a petition and make something happen in your community. And it's empowering when you can vote for somebody and support them and see them win a race and be in position to make change. And you know that person because y'all built a relationship on the campaign trail. Those kind of things are there for us. And we don't always reach out with both hands to grasp them. We're looking, like you said, the shiny objects. But speaking of shiny objects, Waco has become a shiny object for some. Like, ooh, look at the new spot when we, for us, is Wacoans. And myself, a lifelong resident, it's always been shiny to us. You know, the only difference was is it was a little cozy and a little sleepy, but we've always enjoyed the beauty and enjoyed the culture and enjoyed the surroundings of Waco, Texas. But now we have Magnolia, a mega empire in Waco, Texas, ran by Chip and Joanna Gaines. I just want to ask you about Magnolia. We're going to talk a lot about Waco and your thoughts on that, but just Magnolia, how it hit and the ripple
effects. When did you see that happening, and what did you think was going to happen, and has it happened?
You know, I'll start in the premise, and I'll say I got bet for Chip and Joy the game. So, and the lady with the countdown, I don't know why she's counting down because it's still showing me an hour, so don't worry about it. I got a lot of respect for Chip and Joanne and what they do. Their job is to market their company, make money, sell their products. And they're doing the thing. And I got to have crazy respect for that. And they're providing a service. They have vitalized a lot of areas in Waco that absolutely needed it. And wait, God knows Waco needed the image change. So they brought some really, really good things there. So I'm not really an anti-Magno. There's nothing there I really would buy, but just I'm not against anything they do. Where I do have a problem is with the investors, the copycats, the special interest people, and the politicians who have raised people's taxes so high. Folks right now, policemen, firemen, nurses, teachers are struggling to live in that town. I have a problem when I see now that the people who grew up in East Waco, that when I was there, I couldn't even get bathrooms in Hood Park. I asked the city council, I begged, hey, can we get bathrooms over here? We're talking 90s and early 2000s. Can I get sidewalks and people going to Carver and Wiley? The kids didn't have to walk. It's not in the budget. It's not in the budget. It's not in the budget. Now you're building mega-million-dollar hotels. So that part of it aggravates me when I look at people in East Waco who had to endure being stopped by the police for whatever. Let's be honest. We're talking the 90s now. Now, the crime is relatively gone, but there's now the suspicious person in the neighborhood. They've got two generations of them. I don't get it. And I call that antebellum reconstruction. It's not even gentrification. But they didn't. This was not done without a whole lot of folks in positions to know better allowing it to happen. Now, they could come out now and want to speak and, oh, this is wrong. Where were you? This was planned before it was done. It was on paper. You saw the zoning meetings. You saw what they were about to do. They didn't hide anything. There was no opposition. Where were all these leaders at? What did James Baldwin say? I can't believe what you said because what? I see what you do.
Yeah.
And it ain't just black people. It's white people, too, that are struggling right now to keep a house in Waco. You got shacks
You're right about
that. Selling for $400,000 and $500,000 for a shack.
Yeah, taxes
That's
going
crazy.
Up without two in home improvements.
It's crazy. But,
it
you know,
is.
That's
but
the world back in mind.
Yeah, you touched on something. Antebellum Reconstruction.
Antebellum Reconstruction. What does Waco, Texas look like under your lens you're describing as antebellum reconstruction? What's happening right in front of our eyes?
Okay, if we go back and we look at your late 80s into maybe your early 90s, you had white flight. Everybody moved to the suburbs. Everybody ran to the suburbs, so that leaves your area along the river. If we're talking Waco, and to the listeners aren't familiar, we're talking about area East Waco borders the river. That's the black part of town. Brook Oaks and North Waco's neighborhoods border the river that was mostly black and low-income whites. South Waco and Baylor University bordered the river going south. Besides Baylor, all the rest of that property, you could not give a house away. If we went down 4th Street, did Bill Miller houses, white shacks, you could, if you put a sign up that said free, just take it any night, you couldn't give it away. Once the new zoo came in, new fire department, all this, which is good. City improvement is good. I'm not knocking that. But when the citizens came out before they built all that, we did community policing, and I worked with those citizens personally where we got out there on Saturday mornings, and we dug deep enough in the sidewalk to find out, guess what? They do have a sidewalk. We've been asking the city to build one, and we went through 6 inches of dirt and found out you had one all along. We painted houses. The citizens did this work with the police department, And they beautified their neighborhood, and they built it up, and they got some property value raised up that they could afford to have raised up for the equity, and now they can't even afford to live there anymore. Why? Because
mm-hmm.
tourists are coming.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not just coming. They're moving here in droves.
And, you know, I don't blame, like I said, I will not blame Chip and Joanna. I mean, make their money and do what they do. We've got elected people and folks that are in positions on these various boards who are allowing this to happen. At what point, let me ask you this, when was the last time you had a black venue there? Concert, event?
You know, I'm gonna say the closest that we've come to is maybe something hosted by the radio station, being at the Hippodrome mm-hmm. and having maybe a comedian come. But mm-hmm. lately, the two performers that, you know, black people would come to see, like Snoop Dogg, who's coming, and Nelly, who's come, that's been promoted by a white business owner, you know. So being able to bring that kind of talent and afford the opportunity to open a show and make money on it, I hadn't seen that happen a lot for black people in Waco.
Okay, doesn't Waco have a professional basketball team owned by a young black man that grew up in Waco?
Absolutely. The Waco Royals are owned by Mr. Brandon Littles, and they're playing right now their season in our community, and we put some information out there, but we also look at them as a startup, and they need support. You know, they put in the hard work and the paperwork of getting things done, but now that they're out here and what they're bringing, not just in entertainment, but also in value and enrichment to being mentors in our community, you know, we should be getting behind that and want to see them thrive. And what they want to do and what I believe that they would do is open the door for others to come behind them. And that's how
now,
you reach one, reach one, teach one.
Right. Now, Rachel, I'm not there, so you correct me if I'm wrong. I
mm-hmm.
don't see, and I have people like yourself, I probably know more about what goes on Waco than some of those folks who work there because people keep me in the loop. But I don't see the city opening up doors for him like they open them up for Chip and Joanna.
Well, I tell you what, I can give you a little bit of inside track because I had an opportunity to meet the former president, Akeem Stroop, and vice president of operations, Karana Henderson. They reached out to our organization to make some of those touch points for them, and they successfully mm-hmm. sat down with our mayor and city manager. But I have to say this, the outcome of that discussion, it would be up to the Royals to say whether or not it lived up to the meeting, and if they had an agreement or a partnership that was struck, if they feel like it's going well so far. But I do believe that Waco being the home, not only of Baylor University, but the national championship boys team, girls mm-hmm. taking home championships, we've proven that we are a not only a football town, but a basketball town. And anything that brings revenue and economic development to the city of Waco should be supported as much as a Chip and Joanna or a small mom and pop's business. You're
Amen.
Supposed to have resources and support behind them.
Amen. Now, let me ask, and I know you were interviewing me, but I got it because I want to get your opinion on this. South Waco, where there used to be a Hispanic store on every corner,
mm-hmm.
mom and pop Hispanic grocery, all that is replaced now with Taco Bell, Taco Bueno, all these expensive, high-end, pseudo-Hispanic restaurants. You know, what do you say? Because that's where Magnolia is, so everything has been, you know, silovized or siloville. But what do you say to these young Hispanic kids who walk out their door now when you hear, have pride in your culture, have pride in your heritage, and they walk out the front door and they go, where did it go?
Well, you know what?
Does anybody stop to think how they feel?
I do. I'll tell you that, and I'll tell you that South Waco has the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce that is a sister organization of ours that is not just charged with the South Waco area, but the interest
of the Hispanic community at large and being a place where you know, at least in name, this is where you come find out information about the Hispanic community and business and commerce in our city. But I think when you and I'm not even going to say just those kids. I'm a South Waco kid, still live in the South Side. So I saw Kate Ross, the area in front of that where I have church members and family members be bulldozed and turned into hotels and restaurants and parking lot space. It's right down the street from the Gospel Cafe, you know, where they're feeding homeless people and people going through tough times and ministering to them. So it's still like a night and day on two sides of the same street. On one side, you got shiny new street lamps and sidewalks and new buildings. And on the other side, you have the community that you feel like you've always known, but you feel it diminishing. And looking at it through those eyes myself, even where I am, I say we got to fight for it. I'm like you. I'm not a magic carpet to be laid down on and walked on. You know, it may be that we don't always get to stake our claim on the same spot, but we're going to stake a claim somewhere. We're not going to allow you to eradicate and erase what we've spent generations building and enjoying and cultivating. And that goes for businesses as well. You look out there and you say, you know what, I'm getting boxed in by big stores and chains and this and that. We need to support them. We need to fight for them. And for me, just in theory, well, no, I'm not going to say in theory, I have a vision. If I had some buy-in to my vision, we take what we can right now, but we build anew and bigger and better, because exactly what has been done to us, we can do. The blueprint and the plan is there. And once you establish that legacy, years will pass and we'll be dead and gone. And our grandchildren and great-great-grandchildren will be living off of our fruits and expanding on that empire that we established for them. So I would say fear not for what you see, because we're going to fight to preserve our way of life. We're going to fight to preserve our culture. And if we have to make a shift or a move, you better believe it's going to be a gain. We're not going back.
Wow. See, that's 100. Wow.
When me and you talk, and this is, I'm getting off my questions, but when me and you talk, you say, you know, I'm a little bit Malcolm, I'm a little bit Martin. I feel you. Mm-hmm. I'm a little bit Oprah, I'm a little bit Whoopi, I'm a little bit Maya Angelou. And in these days and times, we need that inspiration. We need people that will speak truth to power and not be afraid of what will be taken from them. You know, we fear for our lives. You know, all the time you can get run over walking across the street. But God didn't give us a spirit of fear. He didn't say don't speak up about murder and death and genocide and racism and you know, abuse because you're afraid and want to save yourself. When it's your time, you can't save yourself. So what do you think you're doing right now trying to do my work? I got you. Go out there and do what I asked you to do and what I charged you to do. So that's where I feel like our leaders, we need that kind of leadership. We need them Martin, Malcolms, Mayas, James and Rosas and everybody that is willing to use that position and seat of power for the people to the use and benefit of the people. And if you're not going to do it, then we as the people are going to take you out. We're going to put somebody else in that's going to do it because that's how it's being done to us. And I'm not faulting the player. I'm saying that that's how the game is. You cannot change the game. You cannot rewrite the rules. And you cannot outfox the fox until you actually know what are. So we got to educate ourselves. We got to put people in place that know what we want. And we expect them and hold them to accountability to lead in the direction that we want to go. Anything less than that, we not accepting that no more. It's time out for passing the buck, letting them slide just because they're black and patting them on the back for, you know, being a good face. We need action and we need results. So, you fired me up. But we're gonna talk a little bit about you know, your local politics, because that's where politics begins, in your community. You can shout up to Washington, but your cries may fade out on the way. You know, by the time it gets to the floor, it may be watered down from what you were trying to say when you made your point. But at the local level, these people go to your church, your grocery store, you know, many of them, because it's volunteer positions, they have a day job somewhere else that you may run into them, and they work for you. How do we put these people to work for us, Stan?
You know, one of the things that, am I looking at the council in Waco, that I've been impressed with, I've watched it yearly get younger, which is refreshing, because some of them folks are too old to have been up there sometimes. I'm not saying whether I agreed or disagreed with them, but in seeing some of that younger blood, and I've looked at some of the races and the younger people who were running, I wish there would have been a few more brothers running. There were a lot of women, and that's fine. But I like the fact that the council is getting younger, which says that the direction of Waco eventually will become more progressive and younger. Because you can't build a city on the backs of these old, pasty folks who retired and moved there. They're going to be dead in 20 years. Let's just be real.
Yeah.
And the house will be up for sale. And if Corona or COVID didn't teach Waco anything, I said before I left Waco, I said this when the Hispanic Chamber, Robinson Chamber, invited me to speak in June 2019, before I left. I said, Waco is putting all of its eggs in this basket called tourism. And if anything ever happens to tourism, they're going to be in a world of hurt, and they were. You've got to invest in your people. That middle class that supports that city, cuts the trees and fixes the streets and polices the streets and puts out your fires and the nurses that are in the hospital, these people, the jailers, these people are the backbone of that city. They are what that city is built on, not these investors. Because those investors will shutter up a hotel in a minute and don't care. They'll sell and leave you with the brick. That part.
And I think you opened up something I definitely wanted to dive into deeper. Waco's
diminishing middle class. At one time, when people would recruit businesses or corporations to come in, they would say, hey, you get cheap labor in Waco. It's a $10 an hour town. And it's still that way. Even with all the money flowing in and coming through this city, we have a diminishing middle class that is being priced out. But we are the labor force for this community. You know, that's part of the antebellum reconstruction that you're talking about. The workers move out. They leave. Maybe they still work there, but now they can't afford to live there. You know, how do you fight that? How do you fight that? Like when your pay can't get raised and you're doing nonprofit work or you're doing, you know, double shifts at McDonald's because everybody has quit and you still can't afford to live where you live. How do we fight against the diminishing middle class in Waco?
You know, Rachel, and you've known me a while, most of what I have said from 5 years ago when I first spoke out to now, most of what I said about Waco has come to pass.
Yeah.
Almost everything I've said on this show has come to pass. And I said, Waco, and I'm not an economist, and you know more about this stuff than I do, so if I'm wrong, please set me straight. But what I see is that middle class pretty soon is going to say, it is easier for me to move to Bell County, Temple, clean area, and go to work in the Motel 6 or the Motel 3 twice. But the Motel 6, where I'm not making as much as I made in Waco, but I'm not spending so much in gas.
And
I can afford a house. And I think what's going to happen is your experienced workers are going to migrate to another county they can afford to live in. And even if they continue to work in Waco, they're going to take their dollars now and spend them at home in Killeen or Temple. So guess who's getting that revenue? So now you've got the Central Texas marketplace where all of a sudden nobody goes anymore. Because Waco loses black dollars anyway because there's, besides Crystal's Place, there's nowhere for black people to buy clothes in Waco unless you want to look like a pimp, a thug, or a cowboy. There simply isn't. So where do male black dollars in Waco go? They go to Dallas, they go to Austin, they go to Fort Worth. That's where we spend our money to buy clothes because there is nowhere to buy clothes there. So you're already losing money on a demographic of the shoppers. And you're not they're not addressing it, so apparently they don't care, and that's fine. There's no after-hours venue. Unless something happens, is there an after-hours venue for black people to go to in Waco? Nightclub, anything?
And I'm gonna tell, I'm going to tell you, because I'm fortunate to work in the African-American Chamber of Commerce. This is not about my job. Mm-hmm. These are my personal opinions I'm expressing. But I have the privilege of being able to come across business owners from our community. So I can tell you that there's a new clothing store for black women out at the mall called Angela B's. I can tell you that we have Cozy's Lounge at the edge of Bellmeek Drive, kind of right there for us to go to. But how many Angelas and how many Cozy's do we have? Not a lot. There are people that I see online vending their merchandise or having a pop-up, and that's great. But what I want to see, I'd love to see the Richland Mall filled with black businesses. Let's go buy them all up. You know, let's have a shopping center indoors that caters to our community, because if they're abandoning it, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure. And that's kind of what East Waco was to those investors. They felt like the community looked at it as it wasn't worth the investment, though that's not true. You know, we ain't got the investment dollars you got. But they saw it as something that could be refurbished and shined and made anew. And we have to look through those lenses as well. We have to find those opportunities, because it doesn't always come knocking, and it's not always gift wrapped and presented. But when you see something, you gotta perk up on it and say, let me scratch a little more and dig a little deeper and see what I can do with that. And that's where we got to go. That's that entrepreneurial spirit. So I want to commend people. There are people in our community that have woken up to the fact that, you know, they can create a job for themselves and work for others and wealth for their family. But in a system, again, where we start from behind, we need equity. We need to be able to say, for what was put in and what was taken out by others, we haven't recouped that yet. And since we're not writing, reparations checks, it's up to our elected leaders and our nonprofits and our organizations to put together those packages that we can utilize to get where we need to get. And that's not a handout. That's a hand up. So I commend those who have scratched into that and realize that it's there for them to take advantage of.
And if they want to open a nightclub, and let's be brutally honest, a lot of them don't, because they don't want the hassles that come from the city. There's no reason
why.
Black nightclub, if they want to open a black nightclub before it's even open, there's already plans in the works of how we're going to shut it down. I dare somebody call up here and tell me that ain't true. I know from purchase, I've been in the roll calls. You know, so when you open up one place and you got 400 kids there, and you wonder, why are all these kids here? Well, they got nowhere else to go. You don't give them anywhere to go.
Well, let me say this. I think you opened up something. That was 100, what you said there. But you said something, and I want to stop you there because I want you to expound on that. You said kids have no place to go. What do you expect? We've seen, you know, things like trail rides that used to be a source of camaraderie amongst, you know, a black trail riding group turn out terribly because someone's been run over with a car or a shot. So now it's almost a warning that comes with, you know, going to a certain gathering because – as we like to say, you know, somebody came in there and ruined it for everybody. And that's what happens a lot to the things that we try to establish for one another, that somebody comes in and ruins it. There's already a stereotype or a stigma, and you know you're being watched, but then you come do the thing, and they feel justified in responding the way that they do. But you talked about kids and not having a place to go, and what does that resort to? Well, I'll say this, and I want you to expound on this. What I've seen in years leading up to now, before the pandemic, was an increase in murders of young black men, young black women, young Hispanic men, young Hispanic women in Waco, Texas. And I can name names of friends and family and classmates who have buried their children, and it is heartbreaking. It is heartbreaking to see it, to experience it as a community, but we're still experiencing it. There has not been a stop and an end to it. Just 2 weeks ago, a young man was shot in Trentwood. Where are we failing? Where are we failing our youth?
and I mean, this is for everybody. It's not just for the police that need to solve the murders or be preventive. It's not just parents that need to teach at home and not just teachers. Where are we failing the youth, not just in Waco, but where this is happening, Chicago, where we see this happening, California, where we see this happening, New York, where are we failing our youth that they feel like the thing to do is after something goes awry, whether you're at the party or the corner store, you got to shoot somebody up?
You know, I don't want to say blame any entities, but let's explore this. I've never liked the term young man, young woman, young adults. The church is big on that. The young adults crowd, that's bullshit. There's no such thing as a young adult. A young adult is 18, 19, 20, 21. Fact of the matter is, you have kids and you have adults. And I think what we did starting in the late 80s is we took this 9 and 10-year-old and started calling him young man. Then when he started young adult, so when he started doing adult things, what's the first thing we taught him? Stay in a child's place. So then when he acted like a child, what did we say as a man? Act like a man. So the kid is going, wait a minute, you got hit the brakes. What do you want me to do? See, when we took our little 7-year-olds and gave them pierced ears and lipstick and makeup and full-blown nails and all that as a ritual, not a nice thing to do now and then, a mommy-daughter thing, but when we made it a part of the pampering, now you're raising a young woman that's 9 years old, 10 years old, who's emulating what you do. When mom was trying to dress up in her 15-year-old's clothes and act like one of the B-girls on the street, and dad is running around trying to live out his Michael Jordan fantasy when he's 45 or 50, the kids are raising themselves. And this is not just black kids. I want to make that part clear.
I worked
a whole lot of suicides with some rich white folks who had their kids running crazy and not in check because they were in the Bahamas or wherever, and we left enough money. I don't know why Chelsea couldn't take care of herself. So let's get that out. The problem is we don't allow our children to be children. And guess what? When you find a child and you raise a child and don't allow them ever to be a child, they're not going to be a good mother because they don't know how to be a child. That father is not going to be a good father because he doesn't know how to be a child. We robbed him of their childhood. You got a river that runs all the way through Waco. Why aren't we fishing? Charlie Pack used to do it. Why aren't we taking our kids fishing? You got Bledsoe Miller right there. You got Lake Waco there. Why aren't there bike riding clubs? You got Cameron Park right there, one of the greatest parks in the country. But we have a mindset that's things white people do. No, there are things that are just there for anybody to do. White people just may partake of it, but they don't own the park to the river, and they don't try to. Those fish don't care if they're on a black hook or a white hook. But there's joy in fishing. Why aren't we doing these kids today, I found, they want you to spend time with them, not the whole family, not the whole neighborhood. Sometimes they want to know for one moment they're important. I dealt with someone and they will always tell me, Austin Mason, what I like, man, you talk to me. You made me feel special because you talked to me, not the whole crew. You talked to me. Me and you could talk. People want to be heard or listened to. And that's what they're not listening to them. And we're not allowing our kids to be kids.
You're right. And I think you hit on something, again, important, as you have often in this conversation. Allowing kids to be kids. Michael Jackson himself said he had no childhood, and he was a musical genius. You know, you can do great things, but if you've been put into a role from an early age to live up to a standard that's usually held for adults, you miss out on a lot, you know, and that affects your development and your decision-making. And so being able to say that we should be enriching our kids with things that kids should enjoy, that build character, that, you know, establish morals and a compass for where you want to go, you know, we need mentoring in our community. You know, whether you got it at home or not, there needs to be a place that, you know, enriches and focuses on it. And I'm glad to say we have some. We had some. Our Vision for Youth is one mentor. Mentor Waco is one, and there are many, many more. But, again, to be able to get those in front of our families and our students, that takes somebody opening the door, a gatekeeper saying, you know what, come into our school district, come into our church, come into our neighborhood meeting and doing that. And I say, Waco, I'm proud to say that we have two great community members that have recently gone on to our school board, and that's Keith Guillory and also Jeremy Davis. And Jeremy Davis is the founder of Mentor Waco. So being able to, you know, have someone that's worked with kids at the grassroots level be in a position to affect more change for more of our kids is phenomenal. And we need more of that. That's that civic engagement, not just voting for somebody, but sometimes putting yourself in a position to lead and make some change. Moving on to more subjects about what we got. We talked about a little bit about education, and I know I don't want to speak too much on the character of this person or maybe their actions, but I do want to say what I believe to be true about someone that was a wonderful icon and an angel of hope in our community that's gone too soon, and that's Dr. Marcus Nelson. He was our superintendent of schools, and in the 2 years that he held this job, I saw more change in WISD than I had seen in 20 years. I saw churches, fraternities, myself included, other people from other organizations in the school because he called us to action. He said, nothing's going to happen for our kids with just teachers and principals alone. We need their parents and y'all community members to be there. The tragic part, I guess, of his legacy is that before he left the earth, he left his post and position. And if for us in the black community, I think he knew and saw the support that people gave him because we didn't believe that a small marijuana charge should keep you from doing the work that you were obviously called to do. And I just want to briefly ask you what your thoughts are on what felt like a miscarriage of justice, even though it didn't go to a court system and that charge was dismissed later after, you know, going through the protocols. How do you feel like something like that, it hurts? It affects people. That outcome hurt us. And I just want to know your thoughts on that.
You know, particularly with marijuana, you know, when Vic Fizell was on the show, he wouldn't prosecute when he was DA. And he said on the show, I would not prosecute misdemeanor marijuana cases because it was used as a way to pull over black people in Waco. That was what he said as the DA. He wouldn't do it. And I, you know, I see so much back and forth with, it's amazing how they choose to pursue something, when they choose to pursue something, and how they choose, who they choose to pursue it on. That's what gets me with it. Nothing is ironclad and set in stone or policy. Mm-hmm. The behind-the-scenes voices that weigh in, that have political influence and have money. You know some of these people I'm talking about. We've talked about them. Mm-hmm. They start chiming in. And I see what happened to Dr. Nelson, and I think to myself, I said, wow, where was all this concern for drugs when in the 90s I was looking at BMWs and Mercedes and UConn's with white folks in it in East Waco. They, I know, didn't live there, and I know what you're doing because you're on the street, Rose Street, Sherman Street, Preston Street, Lottie Table. I know what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Where's all of it there? Who gets probation and who gets prison? It's amazing.
Yeah.
And that's the tragedy, is that you can have a law, but there is no clear-cut defined application of it when you get into the court system or how determinations are made. You know, he did bring the community together. He really revitalized the black community and the Hispanic community to be more involved in the schools, after school programs. And sometimes it's almost like and I'm totally not saying that this is what they wanted, but you almost feel like Greenwood. You tell me build my own, get my own, do my own, and once I do it, you come in and burn it all down.
Uh-huh.
And then you say better. It's enough to make you pull your hair out. It's like Tulsa all over again.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I mean, his death was tragic. You know, he lost a lot of benefits and medicines that he needed to survive.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, city with a soul. Isn't that the motto?
Dang.
City with a soul?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll say this as my last comment for Dr. Nelson. I thank him for what he did. I think mm-hmm. that the legacy that he left for us is still going right now, and it's incumbent upon us to make sure that it doesn't die. So I would like to see our community not forget that gentleman and have that incorporated into the fabric of our history of how important, even if it was for a brief shining moment, that man was in catapulting, you know, our students forward and setting fire underneath us to want to be there for it and be there with it. We do have a viewer question, so I'll share that with you and let someone ask. Stephen Carter says, Stan, what qualities embody an upstanding member of law enforcement? So basically, it sounds like, what is a good police officer?
Short answer, anything but a cop. I don't like cops. I think the world doesn't need any more cops. Certainly, American policing doesn't. It needs more police officers. You know, I think that Sir Robert Peel's 9 tenets of policing, which are basically, for lack of a better explanation, the 10 commandments of policing, if people please Google that, Sir Robert Peel, P-E-E-L-E, the Peelian principles, that's what they're called. It's not, I don't even know if it's still taught in the academy. I imagine, I can expect Chief Devlin mentions it. But these were the things that set the table for what a good police officer is. And he's the founding father of modern-day policing in America. That's why English cops are called Bobby. It's after him. But I think we got away from those characters. And just to draw on one of the tenets, you know, I often hear people say, you should respect that officer. You should respect that officer. And Sir Robert Peel disagreed with that. He said that it is not the citizen's obligation or responsibility to respect the officer. It is incumbent upon the officer to earn the citizen's respect. So
mm-hmm.
you see how quickly he did it flipped. We don't give our respect freely to anybody. They got to earn that, especially in the black community. I'm going to tell you now, black people don't give you respect. Being polite and cordial, that's not the same thing. Getting respect and trust, you got to earn that. And that's what Sir Robert Peel was saying in 1829. I think police officers have been used as revenue generators for the city. More emphasis is put on producing statistics and satisfying a for-profit prison system, where rich folks are getting richer off of modern-day slavery, which is put people in jail for anything. We're not going to put you in jail. We're going to put you on probation. We'll have you pay $120 a month for the next 15 years of probation, which is equates out to you could own several Mercedes by then. See, it's all the money.
Mm-hmm.
We're not interested in curing the problem because there's no money in the cure. The money is all in the treatment. So basically being a good police officer is, number one, make sure this is what you're called to do. I don't care what you bench press, what color you are, how many languages you speak, and I don't care if your mom and dad and your baby sister were cops. That doesn't mean you're going to be a good one. You're going to see a lot of bad stuff, and you're going to deal with people in bad moments. It doesn't make them bad people. And if you don't have any empathy, don't come into this job because you're not going to do anybody any good.
You're right. That's 100. All right. Well, I want to talk about something, and that I know, being an officer, you have a familiar relationship, I'll say, with having a handgun
with you every day. You know, it was part of a routine for you as, you know, being employed, and even before that, being in the military, you have that experience and that training. But many of us do not. Let me just start off with the new gun laws in Texas. You know, being able to have a heater on your hip, and for those of you who don't know what a heater is, having a gun on you, visible, in public places. Tell me about this, Stan. How does that happen? Because years ago, you couldn't do that in your neighborhood on your block if you were black. So how are we now opening the gate for anybody to do it?
I got to go back to James Palmer. I say to the Texas legislator, I can't believe what you say because I see what you do. When you're shot with a cell phone in your hand because it might be a gun, you're shot with nothing in your hand because I thought you had something, be careful. They can tell you that you can do it. Yes, you may be legally able to do it, but it's real easy to get shot. And it's because you have some, not all, but some officers who are trained to be afraid of that which is different, which doesn't always mean black. It may be big white guy tattoo. It may be, but they're trained to be afraid almost. And then they're trained to react. Here, I think that was a asinine thing to do, but with Charles Governor, I'm not surprised by it. And I think that it's going to come back, and it's really going to bite Texas because there's already a Wild West mentality there. That's just what it is. It's a Wild West mentality. And y'all are the next chapter of Gunsmoke ready to be written. What do you do now with the officer going to the mental health consumer that has a gun?
You're right.
New law, they can have it. They're suicidal, but they've got the gun on their hip. So we're just going to start shooting them now because they had a gun out of some fear of my life?
Mm-hmm. That's 100, Stan. I want to keep going on it because I don't know what the countdown is, but I want to make sure we get some information out there as well about what is positive that's happening and your thoughts as well. So I want to interject right in there that for the first time today, I went to the gun range with my nephew. He's a member of a shooting club. He bought three of his weapons and his ammunition. I've only shot a gun once before today, and that's probably been 10 years ago, you know, your family out in the country. But the first shot I shot out of a 9mm at a target had my heart pumping like I was on 5 cups of coffee and some speed because that was a foreign experience to me. But I felt like I had someone that I could trust and I was safe, and I needed to know this. And it's in that spirit that I personally spoke to Chief Victorian and a Sergeant Nimmin at the Waco Police Department about organizing an opportunity with the police department to speak to women about handguns. I say this is something for us that is foreign. Although we see around us there are other people that are engaging in it regularly who are inviting family members and kids to go to the range and do for different things, but it's foreign to us. And when laws are being changed and things are going into effect, we're still not taking advantage of it because we don't know the first question to ask or where to ask it. So I will say coming in this summer, we will have an opportunity to do a workshop with women in Waco Police Department and women of the department as well being a part of that to talk to ladies about handguns where you can ask those questions with other women that want to ask the same questions where you can make a decision to say, you know what, I'd like to learn more, become more proficient. I'd like to be an owner. I'd like to be able to educate my children. That opportunity is coming because it is necessary. But one of the things I said to the sergeant when I was telling him why I felt like this was something that we needed to do and why I'd asked the chief to open that opportunity, and I'm glad she said yes, I said there's a stigma in our community. I said it's outside, but even inside our community, that a black person with a gun is dangerous. We might not always want to believe it, but like you say, you know, those biases that we may not realize and acknowledge that we have, we're thinking even if we're a good guy, we don't want to be perceived as a bad guy because, you know, we might get shot.
So how do we break that stigma of saying that, you know, just like we would give grace to somebody in Walmart who's not black with a gun on their hip and think, oh, he may be off duty or military, this or that, how we start making that the norm when we see our black people out here packing and carrying and our brown people packing and carrying and exercising their rights, exercising their Second Amendment?
If we go back to the 60s and 70s, see, history has shown us everything that we need. Gun ranges, whether it's Boy Scouts, whether it was your local youth camps, there was a period in there where you went to the range and there were little 22 rifles and you had your class. Nobody managed to do mass shootings, believe it or not. We weren't shooting up the schools, but we had a culture of people who were educated as to what a gun can do, what a gun is for. And so it goes back to education and introduction. If the only time these kids see a gun is they found where daddy or mommy hides their gun, and I saw on the movies, you turn it play sideways and do this. See, in my era, you grew up with, you had BB guns to play with, you had, you know, the ranges that you could go to, and you shot the little 22s, and you learned what a gun could do. And so the gun became no different than a hammer or a screwdriver or a wrench. You knew what it was, you knew what it does. But because we've taken all guns are bad and nobody gets to touch a gun, our kids are curious. And then when have we shown that? When kids look back at people like Clive and Bundy and his group of armed people who took over, you know, federal property, when they see America's history of guns bring power, when they see how some, not all, some of the officers are with a gun, and then this child sees this thing that represents to them power. Somehow when I grab this, I'm going to have power. Because this is what America's built on. They don't know any of the mechanics of guns, the art of shooting, the history, because we haven't given them those classes.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't taught it. They don't have to shoot bring a gun into the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
The mechanics of shooting, safe fire. You shouldn't have to pay for that. Since Governor Deals on Wheels wants to open up guns for everybody to provide free education, because here comes the question. If you're going to let every citizen carry now, without any mandated training, then why should the citizens pay for the police officers to have to go fire their guns once a year? And all that money we spend shooting rounds downrange, how does the state justify saying this officer must be certified annually to carry that gun? Well, wait a minute. The citizens aren't certified. There's no mandate for them. It's a can of worms.
Very true,
but I
very
think
true.
We need to stop making guns a symbol of power and making them a myth. Educate kids on them. Gun magazine, a Boy's Life. There used to be a magazine called Boy's Life where you could read all these things. And guns weren't a hidden thing in the 60s and 70s. You knew what they were. You could read about them. You could read up on them in the catalog. You know? I mean, me and my brother had a 22 rifle that a man that my dad worked with gave to us. He spent most of his time sitting up at 1820 boats never getting used because, of course, we had nowhere to shoot a 22 around there. But we could go out to his place in York and we'd always take it and shoot it out there. But it gave us an understanding of what guns were.
You need that. You need that. And that's what I say. If we're not brought up in it, how can we train up our children in it?
We got to go get us some education first. And I think Stephen added a good point on here. He said if the NRA was sincere about its support of gun rights, they would help offer classes.
Well, I'll leave the NRA alone because I got my views of the NRA. The NRA didn't help Trayvon Martin's case, and they also didn't help
not at all.
Case either. So, I, you know, NRA to me means yeah, I'll leave it alone. I got a different explanation for their narrative, but you know, I think that's a politically motivated movement, but I agree with Stephen if they were serious, but they're not. You know, they care about one specific group of people, and that's just my opinion of them.
And I say that's a fair enough opinion, Stan, and you would have others that would wholeheartedly agree, and I would say if you can't find it in the organization
that exists, build the organization yourself. So if we want to be empowered and we want an organization that advocates for our rights and offers that, we can absolutely create that. Stephen circled back to something that I had circled on my paper, so I'll take that as confirmation from the above Heavenly Father that I need to go ahead and bring it up. Philando Castile, great, you know, by all accounts of people who knew him, great family man, great man in schools and in the community, licensed, registered gun owner, riding in a car with his wife and his child, and is gunned down right there in that moment. Stephen said, legally exercising his Second Amendment rights, executed by law enforcement. I'm not even going to ask how that happens. How do we not have a police officer, you know, sitting in jail for that?
You know,
at this point, trial over.
Hmm?
I said at this point, with the trial having been, we should have a trial over and have a result with that.
He was no bill. You know, I think I'm glad Stephen brought it up. Philando Castile was actually, when him and then the death of Alton Sterling, that was actually the first Facebook Live that I ever did that led up to all of this and the show and everything. And it's because that had gotten to the tipping point, and Philando Castile particularly bothered me because as a police officer, I have one general order that says when I'm off duty, I'm supposed to carry that gun with me. But then I also know from being black that having a gun with me, they're not going to see a little badge on the other side. They're going to see that gun. And once I'm dead, it's too late. So you're always balancing. You know, and then I see what happened to Philando Castile, and I may be fine in Waco where majority of the officers knew me, some probably didn't. But that doesn't necessarily transfer to Lacey Lakeview or McLennan County or Bell County or dealing with these state troopers out here. And I'm not saying it's all of them, but I can't afford to play the odds. I got to worry about that one.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when it's pulled over now, it is like being in Shreveport pulling a slot machine. You don't know what you're getting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there may be 15 good officers out there and one bad one, but my luck is I'm going to get that bad one.
Yeah, I need something from you on that, Stan, because I'm sure you probably said it a multitude of times on many shows, but I think it's worth saying again. What are your rights when you're pulled over, especially as a gun owner and being a person of color? How do we need to conduct ourselves? How do we make sure that we are being treated fairly, even though you know in situations that might not save you? That's a scary feeling, but we still need to know what to do so we are not the ones who are mistakenly out of line, you know, when we are just trying to abide by the law in the situation. So the question is, how do you act when you pulled over, especially if you have a gun in the car?
The first thing you need to do, and I'm not sure if Texas law has changed, if you can have it on you, not have you on, is it glove box considered safe? It can't be in a reachable place because it all flips around so much. But the most important thing, I don't care about what kind of rims you got, what kind of stereo you got, you should have a dash cam in your car that you can rotate at least 180 degrees, enough to show you and show the window, because you don't need anything. Remember, I worked midnight, so I'm always thinking it's dark. You don't need anything in your hands, nothing. Not your phone, doing Facebook Live. Don't also want to see a phone up in their face, no more than you'd want to see it. So your goal, invest the money in a dash camera. They're not that hard. They plug in and up, plug out, just like a radar detector, which, by the way, if y'all using them to beat tickets, they don't work. But, you know, get you that camera so there's nothing in your hands. Roll all of your windows down. You would be amazed at just when that officer walks up, I don't care if it's day or night, just that he or she can see into your car. They're going to take that ass out and show me that. Turn the music down. Turn my music down. Turn the music down so you can hear what the man or woman is trying to tell you. It's just because you're not in control. You're not going to win that situation out there. Listen to them. You know, have your ID ready. For me, if I'm traveling long distance, it's up on the visor. I just imagine I'm going to get pulled over. I don't want to be in my wallet. I don't want to be moving around no more than I have to. Doesn't matter how nice the officer is, whether they're black or white or whatever. limit the moving around that you got to do. Second thing is just answer the questions, whether you say yes, sir, or no, ma'am, or sir, ma'am, it also really doesn't care. Just answer the questions. And above all, stop looking at these YouTube videos. This is not too bad now, white people, but stop looking at some of these white folks you see in these videos arguing with the cops thinking you can do it because you can't. Number one, you don't even know if you're in a stop and ID state. You may be in a state where you don't have the right to not identify yourself. You will surrender that, I said. Don't be looking at these YouTube videos. Oh, you know, I don't have to show you anything, officer, because then you're going to be in jail. Don't argue on the side of the road. If you're licensed, tell them you're licensed. And if you're driving, guess what? You ain't going to be able to get that gun off your hip and fire it in a threat. The biggest fear for officers, as much as we're trained, is us trying to get a gun out of a holster in a car seat is almost impossible. So if you really want to be protected, having it in your waistband, that ain't going to, it's too hard. By the time you get it out, if somebody wanted to do harm to you, they're already going to do it. Let them know that you have it. I don't know, print out a sign. There's something that's just stuck under your desk. Firearm inside vehicle. So they come up, they can see it. Put it in the back window where they can see it. I would go out of my way, because until Texas figures it out, the officers are nervous. They're not big fans of this. They're nervous and they're scared now. And a lot of citizens are, not of guns, but of irresponsible people with guns. Who can now be clear? You know, and I just think that's the best way to survive the traffic stop. A video camera. Roll your windows down. You don't have to leave them all. Once the officer sees the officer, can I put my windows up? Yes. Roll your windows back up. Turn the music down. Don't argue with them. Do what they ask you to do. You're not going to beat them on the side of the road. You're just simply not going to. We're at three minutes.
Man, okay. Okay, well, I want to highlight with that, though, because you said some things. You said get you a dash cam that rotates 180 degrees. Don't have anything in your hands. Roll your windows all the way down to increase visibility. Turn your music down. If you know you're going to be riding and traveling, especially a far distance, have your ID and insurance, all those things within reasonable reach in your visor if possibly. Limit your movement when they're there. Answer the question. Don't try to be a lawyer on the side of the road arguing your case. You don't be confrontational. And if you have a weapon, let them know that you have a weapon. And hopefully you leave from the situation with your life and a ticket.
And instruct your passengers to be quiet. They're not being pulled over. Yeah. You are. And they ain't going to pay the ticket. So because the more people yelling at that officer, be quiet, and they don't need anything in your hands. You tell them, don't be getting your phones out, pointing them up. I'm recording this. It's going to be good. Because that person in the back grabbing a phone to that officer can look like a gun. Just the movement of you grabbing something and moving your arm pointed toward them, especially in that. So just tell the passengers, too. Y'all be quiet. Nobody needs to say anything. But
yeah, you got
a caller. You want me to bring the caller in real quick? We had 1 minute and 50
Wait,
seconds.
Go ahead. Bring him in.
Okay, caller real quick, 214 area code, 3000.
Hey, Stan. It's your blue,
hey,
behind the blue curtain chief.
Oh, what's up, chief?
Hey, how are you? Just caught the tail end, and you're exactly right. Everything you're telling on the traffic stops, I mean, and your local agency will tell you exactly what you need to do. It's pretty simple. If you got questions, you can contact me. I can tell you how to do it. I teach recruits. I teach continuing education on this, on how these stops occur. But exactly, 100%. Everything that said is 100%. Don't make furtive movements. Have everything ready to go. Don't argue, because we don't argue on the side of the road. Other than that, man, hey, love your brother. Fantastic.
Appreciate you.
I love being part of the show and part of the community. So, with that, I'm out, my man.
All right, chief. Appreciate you. Rachel, the last 50 seconds is yours.
Okay.
I think we only scratched the surface, but it was, again, a privilege and an eye-opening opportunity to pick your brain, and we could do this all day long, but the best way for people to really see not just who you are, but what you're trying to open people's mind to is to watch Behind the Blue Curtain. Behind the Blue Curtain explores more than just policing. It has become, for me, a place where I tune in for intelligent dialogue, for news, for expert opinion, and even for some contrasting opinion as well. I mean, it's hearty debate at times between people, but it's always respectful and it's always enlightening, and we don't have enough of that. So I applaud you for using your platform, even in the midst of, you know, the things that you go through that people will never know. And I just want to ask you one final question, because even though it was my show tonight, it's your show. What haunts you about what you've gone through, what you've done, whether it's policing or life, and how would you have done that differently, or how do you rectify that moving forward?
I think the answer to that is a lot of good kids that made bad choices, lifestyle choices, but were respectful of me that were killed. Some of them I knew, and you always say, could I have done more? I saw him on the street one day. Maybe I should have stopped that day and talked. That's just natural. You know, you things are going to happen, but I think sometimes you say, maybe I could have been there more. That really, to me, is the biggest thing. I don't regret as far as speaking up when I did. I don't. I lost a lot of things in doing it. A lot of people stopped speaking to me that really didn't know me as well as they thought they did, but you know, I would do it all again, because for every person that I worked with that didn't speak to me or had something bad to say, there were 10 people on the street that I never met that said, hey, man, you're speaking for me. So it's worth it.
All right. All right. And I guess that's our last word. Again, I thank you. I thank you for turning the reins over to me and giving. You're welcome. I'm saying I'm a girl from Waco. I'm a hometown girl. And you inspire me, you motivate me, you encourage me, and you empower me. And everything that you give to me, I hope to be able to give to somebody else. So thank you for all that you've done for our community, for our youth, and what you are still trying to do and sowing seeds today for progress and prosperity that you may not even be here to see, but you are making an impact. And thank you for helping me champion making an impact too.
All right, I appreciate you. Thank you so much for doing this. And I know my brain is a scary place for somebody to be, you know, so thank you for putting up with it.
Yes, sir. Anytime. I told you, you can always call me. I can pop up and talk on any day.
Oh, yeah, because I'm going to take you up on that, because I could have used you the other night when I had Cletus or whatever his name was.
And I said, tighten up on your backstroke.
Hey, but I appreciate that. And I know it's going to cut us off here in a second, but thanks again.
Thank you, and thank you to Stan's audience for tuning in. Thank you for the dialogue, for the encouragement, and the great questions and the call-in. We appreciate you.
All right. Waco, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, ATL, we're out. Love everybody. Thank you, Rachel. Have a good night.
Good night.